Okay, today what I'm going to talk about is a people's history, a lens to understand the past and the future. So I'm going to pick my prime talk, my prime example from my new book, A People's History of the German Revolution, which I'm completing as we speak, and it will be available next year. But I still have copies of A People's History of Modern Europe, as has been pointed out. So let me begin. It's well known that most history is written from the vantage point of the victor. History is viewed from the perspective of the rich and the powerful, and the actions of a small number of people, generally white men, are seen to dictate the course of world affairs. History of this kind continues to dominate both academic and popular literature, despite challenges from historians who've tried to write history from different perspectives, including that of ordinary women and men. Whether it was George Roudet and his famous crowd in the French Revolution, E.P. Thompson in England, or Howard Zinn in the United States. This history from below is noted, at times even celebrated, but ultimately put back on the shelf while historians return to writing books and articles that lead more easily to research funding and professional appointments. But there are deeper reasons for this neglect of what we are calling people's history. It is quite simply easier to write about prime ministers, great industrialists, and their ilk. They often write memoirs, leave papers to archives, or in the case of American presidents, build huge museums to house papers that they want the public to see. Writing history from below is a challenge because the historical record is scattered and largely neglected. But it is a challenge worth taking up. We seek to shine a light on that which, as Sheila Robotham, a feminist historian, once said of women's history, has been hidden from history. And there's a famous poem by Bertolt Brecht that I think sums up the way I try to look at people's history. It's called Questions from a Worker Who Reads History. And at the risk of taking too long reading poetry in a historical talk, I really want to read this poem to you because it gives you a real feel, I think, for things that we just often don't even think about. So he says, Brecht says, "Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with the name of kings. Was it the kings who hauled the craggy blocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, that glittering city of gold, lived those who built it? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Imperial Rome is full of arcs of triumph. Who reared them up? Over whom? Did the Caesars triumph? Byzantine lives in song. Were all her dwellings palaces? And even in Atlantis of legend, the night the seas rushed in, the drowning men still bellowed for their slaves. Young Alexander conquered India. He alone? Caesar beat the Gauls. Was there not even a cook in his army? Philip of Spain wept as his fleet was sunk and destroyed. Were there no other tears? Frederick the Great triumphed in the Seven Years' War. Who triumphed with him? Each page of victory, at whose expense the victory ball? Every 10 years a great man. Who paid the piper? So many particulars, so many questions." So while the scholar must avoid fake history, making sure the facts are correct and so on, the problem is, despite cliches to the contrary, facts never speak for themselves. They only speak when called upon by a historian, a writer, or a speaker. People sometimes want to learn only the facts and an objective reading of the past. The problem with this, as E.H. Carr, the noted British historian, says, is, quote, "Facts of history cannot be purely objective, since they become facts of history only in virtue of the significance attached to them by the historian." Another way of putting this is to say that there are so many possible facts out there that, to some extent, every historical work suffers from a bias of selection. You have to pick and choose which facts you think are important enough to use. Another problem is that the thoughts, hopes, and fears of average women and men often is interred with their bones. In other words, they die without leaving any written record behind. It is different with the upper heights of society. While a Krupp may leave rooms full of documents and correspondence, a Krauss, that is to say, an average German, often leaves behind only a handful of trinkets that may not readily speak of their lives. This bias of survival means historians find their work much more difficult than when looking for the historical footprint of common people who normally leave neither massive archives nor long-published biographies. Unfortunately, most historians are all too human and subject to the emotions, prejudices, and ideological assumptions that plague their species. So many historians unwittingly fall into confirmation bias. This means they search and interpret evidence to fit within a preconceived set of beliefs. Let us take the case of Winston Churchill, well-known British politician, later Prime Minister during World War II. He commented extensively on the revolutions that rocked Europe towards the latter part of the First World War. Now, he did acknowledge certain material and economic factors on some occasions, but Churchill continued to return to a conspiratorial view of history. Talking of the schemes of, quote, international Jews, the future World War II leader contended that from the days of the Illuminati to those of Karl Marx and down to Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overflow of civilization and the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development, of enviance, malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing. He also blamed Jews for the tragedy of the French Revolution. Now, although immediately one recognizes a certain odor of anti-Semitism here, there's something else going on. Churchill thinks that history is made by only a handful of individuals. Some good, like himself, of course, and some evil, like these international Jews he's talking about. So the fact is, he has a great person theory of history. He believes that it's only a few individuals that are actually going to make history, besides the fact of his obvious racism and anti-Semitism, which is Marx's career. Moreover, ruling classes spend a lot of energy, both consciously and unconsciously, to promote a sympathetic historical narrative. Why else would they build all these monuments and museums? One thinks of Robert E. Lee more recently. Why create universities or support unemployed intellectuals like the Rockefellers paying Henry Kissinger after he was denied tenure at Harvard just because he needed a couple, 50 grand here, 25 grand there, to keep him writing? The problem is, as one scholar noted, that all rulers need an interpretation of the past to justify the authority of their government. And this is a very important point he makes. The past has always been the handmaiden of authority. So let me use a German example. Compare and contrast the German History Museum on Unter den Linden in central Berlin. 1988 versus 2018, let's say. In 1988, the museum was oriented towards the political line of East Germany's ruling party. That meant that Martin Luther was bad and peasant revolts were good. 30 years later, now that it's controlled by the reunited under West German control, it is in sense the other way around. Martin Luther is good and German peasant revolts are bad. So you can sort of see very dramatically there, if you visited that museum before and after, as I have, how history is changed to create a certain image that wants to be preserved. So we must remember that history is more than a parade of famous men with the occasional token woman thrown in for diversity. The idea that only a few individuals make history has a long and deep pedigree and is only overcome with difficulty. One admired British historian, who should have known better, A.G.P. Thompson, said, and I quote, "History of modern Europe can be written in terms of three titans, Napoleon, Bismarck, and Lenin," end quote. If needed and time allowed, this example could be amplified by hundreds of comparable pronouncements. At least in the English-speaking word, German history starts with Otto von Bismarck, unification, goes through Kaiser Wilhelm II, evil militarist, pausing to dwell on the unique evil of Hitler. But there's a myth here, and this is one of the myths I want to tackle, and that is that the Germans went not only willingly, but enthusiastically to war in World War I. A close look at the evidence, particularly evidence recently unearthed, shows that that's not true. In fact, no other nation involved in the war did the common people spend so much effort to try to prevent their government from going to war. The common people of Germany repeatedly protested against war in the years before World War I. even the conservative rural population was against the war, if for no other reason than the very practical reason that the farmers feared losing their harvests. Certainly there were signs of war fever, but as one historian notes, in most cases, officials seemed to have been the moving spirits in the noble enterprise of encouraging people. True, crowds gathered in Berlin to cheer the Kaiser and his wife, but their enthusiasm was no greater than in peacetime. In other words, it was the same crowd of monarchists that always came and cheered the Kaiser. It was not augmented by newly patriotic people by any means. Another myth is that the leaders of Germany had no reason till late in the war to think they'd be defeated. In the most extreme version, the so-called stab in the back, the theory that was popular among the Nazis and other far-rightists in Germany is that Germany should have won the First World War had it not been for traitors at home. This is simply untrue. The German High Command, under Erich von Falkenhayn, chief of the German General Staff, planned to strike a fast and fatal blow at France in the west while holding off Russia and their enemies to the east. This plan, basically a repeat of Prussia's successful strategy in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870-1871, depended on the capture of Paris, destruction of the French army, and surrender of France before significant numbers of British or Allied soldiers could engage German troops. Once the French were able to halt the German offensive and the war bogged down into trench warfare in the fall of 1914, everything changed. At that point, Imperial Germany could have negotiated a favorable treaty in return for the evacuation of occupied French, Belgium, and Russian territory. What they could no longer hope for was a quick victory, or in fact, victory at all. Now, where do I get this idea? Well, none other than Chief of the German General Staff, von Falkenhayn, told the Chancellor of Germany on November 18, 1914, when everybody saw victorious German armies occupying Western and Eastern Allied soil, and I'll quote him, "As long as Russia, France, and England hold together, it will be impossible for us to beat our enemies such that we will get an acceptable peace. We would instead run the danger of slowly exhausting ourselves." This warning, as we all know, was ignored by the government. Realizing that the leader of the German army knew the war was almost certainly unwinnable, this sort of redeems the so-called defeatism of many average German soldiers. Some understood the military balance of power, at least dimly. Others just had a gut feeling. But many who could resist the nationalist propaganda came to the same conclusion as von Falkenhayn. The war was lost before Christmas 1914, and any further death and suffering served no purpose, not even for the pro-war patriots. Thus, increasingly, German soldiers took matters into their own hand. At Verdun, a disillusioned volunteer named Hermans kept remembering the whispered slogan making the rounds in the trenches. And that slogan was, "A bullet from the rear is just as good as a bullet from the front." The meaning was, why not a rifle be turned against our own superiors? He knew one of his lieutenants was marked for having an accident, a bullet from behind. He happily didn't inform the lieutenant that his death was imminent. So maybe the German officers saved their honor, but in fact, the working class, the average peasants in the German army, by and large, were not sympathetic to the war effort at all. For example, during another famous battle, during the Battle of the Somme, a man named Dawson, who was a British sergeant, managed to get himself hopelessly stuck in the mud, and he couldn't get out. He panicked when he saw a group of five German soldiers approaching him. He assumed, at best, they would take and make him a prisoner of war, if not shoot him. Instead, they informed him, quote, that they were his prisoners and demanded to be taken over to the British trenches. Dawson, unfortunately, wasn't good at geography, so he got them lost. But all turned out well, because the Germans found the way to the British trenches, where they promptly surrendered. You also had a situation going on at the home front, which was supposedly, again, in the mythology, so patriotic and so supportive of the war effort. As early as February 16, 1915, officers of Berlin police reported on a riot where potatoes were to be on sale. As the sale began, everybody stormed the market stalls. The police, who were trying to keep order, were simply overrun and were powerless against the onslaught. And this was not unique to Berlin. There are reports coming out of Amsterdam in 1915, which was neutral, receiving reports that bread riots were widespread, while the rich were traveling to Scandinavia to get bread. And at Magdeburg, for example, women and children endeavored to loot stores only to be suppressed by the police. In other words, there was widespread domestic unrest long before the collapse at the end, long before the army had been defeated, while things still, from a superficial point of view, looked very good for Imperial Germany. Moreover, there's other evidence that average German troops were not the war-crazy machines of popular legend. A young woman, Toni Sender, reports on the attitude of soldiers she met during the first year of the war. Remember, the first year of the war, when it looked like Germany might still win. Many people thought Germany would still win. She rode with a group of troops headed to the front, and she was surprised to find that, quote, most were not too enthusiastic about fighting. After deciding that she wanted to help wounded soldiers behind the line, she was also shocked, not just by their physical injuries, but by their attitude. The typical attitude, it was plain, was that they were mighty glad to be out of the trenches and not eager for their wounds to heal too quickly. A homeland shot, they used to call a serious wound that kept them off the battlefield for a long period of time. Morale was further undermined as the high command was unable to stop the spread of rumors and gossip. Even the first months of the great conflict, word spread among the soldiers that so-and-so had had a mutiny, that in such-and-such a place people had been fraternizing with the French. Here they poured down coffee on the ground in front of a general, and there a soldier shot an officer in the line. So in other words, there's this whole subculture of disillusionment, protest, and anger, which is spreading, whether any specific incident was true or not. But worse than the rumors from the point of view of the German high command in Imperial Germany was the fact that there was a reality to many of these. So, for example, one soldier remembers how over time, sitting in the trenches next to the Russians, people became more and more friendly. This is, again, early in the war, 1915. Once, the Russians had a problem. They'd failed to get resupplied by their incompetent Tsarist administration, and they were on the brink of starvation. So they sent a representative across no man's land with a white flag, and they begged for food. After the initial shock, sacks were, quote, filled with gifts of our soldiers to the enemy, pieces of bread and biscuits with here and there a slice of bacon or a lump of cheese, all thrown together. Many a man parted with his last piece of bread in order not to be outdone by the others. So in other words, you have starving Russian troops. What did the Germans do? Give them their food. This is, again, not a sign of a war-crazed, bloodthirsty thing. Now, there were people who were bloodthirsty, particularly the officers. So, for example, during the invasion of France, a group of officers screamed no quarters, and German soldiers were told to kill defenseless French troops who'd thrown away their rifles while trying to surrender. If any German hesitated, their superior squad cut them all down. And they were. They have to follow orders, right? This sort of senseless slaughter did not sit well with the average German enlisted man. The result was that some of the, quote, gentlemen who had ordered the massacre, quote, of our French comrades were killed by mistake in the darkness of night by their own people, of course. Such mistakes repeat themselves almost daily. Now, this was caused not by the frustration of defeat, as the Germans still thought they were winning the war and still told themselves they'd be in Paris for Christmas. This was not frustration of defeat, which sometimes people focus on. This was very early on. And what about Christmas 1914? Although for years it was ignored and only recently has been accepted, there were Christmas truces up and down the line on the Western Front. Throughout, you would see unofficial, illegal, treasonous, even, agreements made between French and German or British and German troops to observe a truce. One British private response in his diary talks about it, and he says, the Germans were singing Silent Night, Holy Night. Then the Germans put out a sign saying, Merry Christmas in English. The British responded by joining in the singing. German troops waved their hands above the trench tops and yelled, Happy Noel, Tommy. Next one German took a chance and jumped up on top of the trench and screamed, Merry Christmas, Tommy. No one fired a shot. Of course, our boys said, if they can do it, we can do it. The sergeant major came along and said, get down there, get down. We stuck out our two fingers up at him and said, it's Christmas. And with that, we all jumped up and the Germans beckoned us forward to the barbed wire where we shook hands. Again, not warlike in any sense. Now, of course, sometimes things didn't go that smoothly. On one part of the front, the German troops were furious that the enemy kept shooting at them on December 24th, and that all their pleas about Merry Christmas were ignored. Finally, a really determined pastry chef from Berlin refused to accept the rejection of the truce. Named Alfred, he screamed, no one can do this to me, grabbed a Christmas tree and lifted it high above his head, and started marching towards the enemy trenches. It turns out those trenches were filled with Algerians who followed the Islamic faith, and they had no understanding of this Christmas stuff. But the Algerians were baffled by this chef. The German appeared too crazy to shoot at and too comical to take seriously. So the Algerians agreed to honor the truce. Now, obviously, the high command didn't like this and made sure that severe punishment was meted out, particularly that any repetition of this in future holidays, like say, next Christmas, would be severely punished. So was this the end of it? No, because even though they couldn't overtly fraternize in many cases, they fell into what is sometimes called a live and let live policy. That is to say, they basically didn't really disobey direct orders to attack, but when they're in their trenches, they often made a mockery of the fighting. They turned to ritualized aggression, as one historian has called it, where the troops made a noisy show of firing off their rifles. So what, quote, an outsider might perceive as a small battle, entirely consistent with an active front policy, might in fact merely be a structure of ritualized aggression where missiles symboled benevolence, not malevolence, and where a constant flow of ritualized bombs and bullets caused neither harm nor anxiety. In other words, it was much easier to fire off rounds if your goal was to miss the enemy rather than hit them. At times, when you had line officers who were sympathetic, the German infantry could dispense altogether with the charade of wanting to kill the enemy. In one section of trenches, there was an unspoken understanding between German and British troops not to needlessly shed blood. And in that context of this sort of unofficial truce, some very strange things could happen. For example, and Bob will appreciate this, a Scottish soldier had misappropriated the daily rum ration and became very drunk. The Scot, quote, staggered drunkenly into no man's land and lurched along the battalion's front, all the while taking frequent swigs from a stone jar containing rum. The inebriated Scot was in full view of the German troops, who not only refrained from firing, but laughed and cheered him along. An officer reports that in another section of the front, two British soldiers got into a huge fight. They jumped out of the trench and fist fought barehanded for 15 minutes until one was knocked out. As the officer reported, all the time the Germans were cheering and firing the rifles in the air to encourage the combatants. So if the first war on the German home front was horrible, the months following were even worse. In other words, things were bad at home, too. The British had a naval blockade, and so the British were able to stop Germany from getting in food. So the common people, who already were not necessarily super enthusiastic about this, became more and more upset. Basically, you have a situation where food rations kept dropping and dropping and dropping, and people couldn't even easily drown their sorrows, as 95% of the grain used for brewing beer was diverted to wartime uses. But the real sort of insult came in the summer of 1916 where the government started to introduce saccharin into beer. This alteration was deeply resented by people because they believed saccharin almost ruins a good beer. So, you know, you had these things happening at home. And, of course, the response is often riots over food. Another report from the Berlin police in the fall of 1915 talks about how a crowd had stormed several butter shops because of prices. Large display windows were shattered. Shop doors were destroyed. Entire stocks simply taken. The police and officers were completely helpless against the crowd. While newly arrived mounted police cleared the street, various objects such as flower pots were thrown at us. In other words, openly defying the authorities, fighting with the police. Again, I want to note the date. 1915, we're not talking about the war's lost, not talking about the war's over. Right? Very, very quickly. Now, one of the reasons why they were so upset is, despite the rationing system, is you had a reality where the rich were still living rather well. So a British noblewoman who'd married a German nobleman and become a princess wrote in her diary in 1915 that they, the aristocracy and the rich, and officers on leave would come home and have dinners where they had, quote, pheasant served on slices of pineapple with champagne is a mere item on a long menu. And the frontline soldiers caught wind of what was happening, and this furthered their anger. So, for example, one soldier on furlough found that there were vaults and cellars in the Imperial Castle, where the Kaiser lived in Berlin, were filled with mountains of canned goods and so on, all sorts of things. Now, whether he knew, heard rumors, or guessed, the fact is we now know that that story is true, that there was that sort of food being stored for the rich. So to try to relieve the anger of the average people of Germany, they started having food substitutes. Right? Instead of a normal food, they try to have something different. Most familiar to people here is probably their most successful food substitute was this powder that you mixed with water, and it gave you this sort of translucent thing that filled your stomach, even if it didn't have much nutrition. We call it Jell-O. So that's one of the things they did. But you had all sorts of other things. Meat was substituted by rice lamb chop, nut cutlet, vegetable beefsteak, a pale green concoction of cornmeal, spinach, potatoes, and group nuts bound by egg. Sausages were made from starch and offal. Butter was stretched by a powder made from starch and sodium carbonate, or replaced with curdled milk, sugar, coloring material. And many attempts were made to develop substitutes for fat, which was a real problem, real deficiency on the home front. And among the things they tried to use to substitute for fat were rats, mice, hamsters, crows, cockroaches, snails, and earthworms, even hair clippings and old leather boots. But none of them were very successful, partly because there was a cultural resistance to eating cockroach pate, which was something they developed as a healthy alternative and as a source of protein. You can imagine, people are probably familiar with cockroaches here, you can imagine that if you don't try to kill cockroaches, but rather try to get them to reproduce under laboratory-type conditions. They had a whole building full of cockroaches that were fed things that were unedible to humans, you know, fingernail clippings, et cetera, and the roaches flourished and so on. Then they would take them, you know, German industrial efficiency, and they would pasteurize them and make them into a pate. And the pate was very popular for about 2 weeks until the word got out that the pate was made. It said organic pate, which was true, but when they found out it was cockroaches, it became not very, very popular. Right? So in an empty and egalitarian gesture, everybody was supposed to be subject to the same rationing. However, for those with money, there was always food to be had on the black market that flaunted price controls. One socialist woman described the reality of the rationing system for the average German. Bread tickets were always insufficient for many hungry mouths. Tickets were issued for meat you often could not get or did not have the money to buy. Butter and fat tickets did not mean you could obtain the quantity indicated. More often than not, the word butter on the ticket was all one saw of butter. And there were various spontaneous demonstrations taking place. So that princess I referred to before, Frau von Blücher, she talks about seeing in Germany's capital 200 women marching down the Unter den Linden, calling out, you know, peace, peace. You know, their only made to desist when 150 mounted police attacked them with drawn swords. And that was a small demonstration, but there was consistently more and more of these. Right? Also, women were very important in terms of organizing anti-war propaganda. So a socialist woman talks about being called to the Frankfurt Customs House, where she would have to pay duty on some packages she'd received from Switzerland. She had a feeling that they probably contained prohibited literature. Now, she tells of her anxiety as the officer unwrapped the parcels and dozens of books fell out. She was relieved when she said, "I saw the paper cover and it said Perfidious Albion, the slogan used against England by the German nationals during the war." Rapidly, the officer looked through the book. "Seems to be good patriotic stuff," he said. "Certainly, officer," was my reply. Had he been a little more careful, however, he would have discovered that under the paper cover, the real title, J'accuse, was a book written by a German accusing Germany on the basis of official documents of her share of war guilt. Had, of course, he read this, she would have wound up in jail. Now, what was the mood of the average soldier by 1916? Leftist accounts assure us that many were ripe for revolt. But then they would, wouldn't they? Leftists would say that. So it might be useful to turn to a middle-class, non-socialist Christian eyewitness to verify the radicalism spoke of in radical socialist circles. I want to use this case study. Johannes Haas was middle-class and a devout Christian. At the start of his service, the two most pressing issues he wrote home about was, one, his disgust with soldiers who circulated pornography. And secondly, the trouble he was having trying to decide whether he'd become a clergyman after the war. This is how this fellow, thought. But by 1916, he'd become bitter about what he called champagne and wine officers who party while, quote, "we are living in filth." Reporting on the mood of the average soldier, he states, "the only man who has any sympathy for or confidence in the private soldier is that ranter Liebknecht," who's a famous anti-war socialist who voted against war credits. "That, and not the drivel of those who write dispatches, represents what the field grays really feel." Now, remember, he's middle-class, Christian, conservative. He goes on to say, "I don't agree with the popular saying, quote, there will only be peace when the bullets are aimed in the opposite direction. But all the same, there'll be a fearful awakening someday. We'll never know whether he would have decided later to aim the bullets in the opposite direction, because he was killed June 1st, 1916, at Verdun. Now, before the war, there'd been massive anti-war demonstrations throughout Germany. During the war, there were anti-war demonstrations despite the repression. And in fact, people often ignore the fact that when people went to a demonstration against the war during the war, they knew that they'd meet mounted police with swords drawn. And yet, they still did that. They still came on. And it wasn't like they were just trying to maintain public order, because once there was a counter-demonstration against a patriotic demonstration led to a bit of fighting, and of course the police came in and just attacked the anti-war demonstrators. In fact, one historian concludes that there was no evidence of any war enthusiasm in three major areas of the country. In the countryside, peasants worrying about their harvests and so on, in the working class areas of large cities, representing a huge portion of the German population, and in areas near the border. In other words, areas where they expected to feel the pain of a counterattack. Now, there was war enthusiasm, of course, but this was basically more like a drunken crowd rioting, like frat boys rioting or something. Why do I say that? Because the Stuttgart police chief complained of the so-called patriotic crowds and how they were little more than drunken mobs who see their duty, quote, to beat the spy, a person they think is a spy, and then beat the policeman who protects the spy until everyone is bloody and very least make a big scene. On the other hand, average people would probably be more sympathetic to the view of Katie Kollwitz, a left-leaning artist, who wrote in early 1917 of attending a performance, again, scarcely legal, of the story of a waiter whose son falls on the field of honor. Kollwitz describes how she could scarcely keep control of herself and felt she was not the only one. When the final word of the play was read, it was peace, someone in the audience called out aloud, as though overpowered by a tremendous emotion. "Peace, peace," again and again. There you have a peep behind the scenes. There you see the true feelings of people who, to all appearances, are bearing the war well. By this time, by 1917, even among the upper classes, they realized that things were changing. So that Princess von Blücher, I mentioned previously, she writes in her diary that one of the strangest signs of the time is, to my thinking, the rapid and insidious way in which the tide of democracy is creeping on and overflowing all Europe. Notice she doesn't say communism, doesn't say revolution, she says democracy. She's very clear what she's afraid of, democracy. By the end of the war, Kaiser Wilhelm caught a rather pathetic figure whose actual influence on political decision-making was comparatively unimportant. He had become a mere fig leaf for the rule of the generals and large industrials who actually controlled the Reich. When his usefulness was over, the Kaiser was sacrificed by his most trusted field marshals in an attempt to save the empire and, if possible, the monarchy. He was sent into exile to the Netherlands on a night train like a tired Caesar in flight, and that was the end of Imperial Germany. Now, all of these things I said are not like secret or conspiratorial. The facts are out there if you know where to look for them, if you gather them up, but in fact, they're ignored. Instead, you always have the pronouncements just of the great and the good about how they felt about things. So these case studies I just mentioned show that we must look at the action of common people to understand history. It's not the only lens to understand history, but it's a vital lens. Of course, people don't make history in conditions they're choosing. Still, they make history. Thank you. Yes, and I think that's the sort of history that doesn't get reported. Or if it's reported as the exception that proves the rule. They don't really emphasize how actually many times people stand up to this at risk of their own lives, as you did, of course, when the officer pointed the gun at you, and actually stood up to it. And sometimes it's the individual officer's fear of consequences. Maybe they're afraid if they kill the soldier, the other soldiers will kill them, right? Because they're afraid of the mood of their men, so on. It could be for a lot of reasons. But people show a lot more day-to-day heroism against war than you'd ever know, because all the war movies we see always show people being heroes in defense of the war, in the fighting the war, in defense of the system, not fighting the system.
He's absolutely below the Mendoza line, less than zero, was the fact that, like, all discipline had broken down in the army. We've subsequently seen where...
Well, let me just comment on that. I think that this is one of those sort of dogs that don't bark, because if you kill your officer, you usually don't tell anyone, or at least you don't tell it to anyone outside your circles, certainly not at the time. And I think there's a lot more killing of officers that goes on in these wars than people let on. I mean, I was kind of surprised when I stumbled upon memoir after memoir, long after the fact written, or letters just finally released, where people talk about fragging, as we would say in Vietnam, but talk about killing their officers, that how widespread it was. So people went to Verdun. By that time, it was, maybe everybody didn't do it, but it was a common saying, right? This was like a saying that all the soldiers knew, you know, and new recruits were regularly initiated by the troops at Verdun to tell them, a bullet from behind is good as a bullet from front. So in other words, if you have an officer who's particularly inhumane or gives you absolutely suicidal orders, you know, when he says, follow me, boys, you know, he can take a bullet and, you know, let somebody else try to figure out where it came from, right? So this goes on a lot, and I would be surprised if we could ever know. And this is a good example of what I meant about trouble with trying to find evidence for people's history. I mean, this is the sort of thing that there's probably not much documentation on. Any documentation that armies may have gathered on this was probably not just classified, but probably destroyed. It's not the sort of thing that if you were a general, you'd want to report to the higher-ups that your officers are being killed by their own men. But, like, for example, of the German officers who started in 1914, something like, depending who you listen to, 20 and 25% of them were dead by the end of the war. Okay, so The question is, most of them were no doubt killed by enemy fire, but some of them were probably killed by their own men. And I thought it was particularly interesting that this was not an act of frustration, people who thought the war was over, why continue dying. There were many, many cases I found, as I tried to quote a few, where German soldiers were shooting their officers at a time they thought Germany was winning the war, and they thought that they'd be in Paris by Christmas. But they just thought these officers were barbarians. I didn't quote it. It's another case where some Belgian civilians were mistreated by an officer, right? And then it was reported the next day that a Belgian sniper had somehow killed that officer with a stolen German Mauser. Well, okay, maybe that's true. Maybe it was a Belgian sniper with a stolen German rifle. But on the other hand, I suspect it was one of his own men. Killed him for abusing Belgian civilians.
So we humans are not as f***ed up as I believe that we are.
I think that's an important point, too, because for the wars to continue, they like to spread this myth that people are so f***ed up that it's all they can do is kill, and they give them half a chance to go mad, and that most people think they were born on this earth to blow up, smite, use predator drones, napalm against their fellow human being. And that's not true in every case. In fact, there are many people who stand up and resist that. And those are the people you never hear of, except when there's some famous case or something. You just don't hear about that.
Soldiers in Revolt details not only infantry soldiers shooting their officers, fragging them, going missing to avoid combat, but mutinies on aircraft carriers where equipment was being intentionally damaged, where ships were being delayed departure because people were not showing up or they couldn't start something. I think it also supports that the image we're given to condition us to believe that patriotism means killing the designated enemy is one that's constantly in need of stimulation. I don't know if you want to address that, if it relevant to your research.
Yes, I think it's very relevant because what we have seen, you talk about Vietnam, I remember reading an estimate that between 20 and 25% of all the bombs dropped in Vietnam were dropped intentionally by U.S. pilots in the sea. Now, the point is, they had a reason for this, they couldn't find a suitable target, blah, blah, blah. Well, I sometimes find that hard to believe that they could never find a suitable target. But getting back to the topic I was discussing, another thing I didn't mention during my prepared remarks, I was trying to make it as concise as possible, is this didn't even mean just the front lines. You also have it back in the artillery officers. You'd had artillery officers who would sometimes go along with this live and let live policy, and they would regularly do their duty, and they would fire off tremendous barrages against the enemy. The point is they would fire them at the same time every day in the same place where the enemy wasn't, like in no man's land. And in return, the British or the French would return the favor, and they would have a huge barrage. So if you read the papers and you're a high officer, we fired off 300 shells into enemy lines, and they responded with 200 shells and so on. It was all a game. It was all a game that they obviously couldn't announce to their superiors, but they were not trying to hurt people, just the opposite. They were trying not to cause casualties, and this was partly pressure from below, where you'd have line officers saying, hey, the French aren't trying to hit us with their artillery. If you hit them, they're trying to hit us. You know, so here are coordinates we want you to shoot at because it's harmless. It's blowing up, you know, empty real estate. You know, so, I mean, it really permeates the whole thing. I didn't even talk about the German Navy. The German Navy, for example, is going to have a revolt that starts the German Revolution of November 1918, where they just refuse to carry out these massive suicidal orders. The German admirals, let me explain just briefly, German admirals had this goofy idea. I think it was goofy. They were going to get the entire Imperial German high seas fleet, and they were going to charge the British Navy that was supporting the blockade for one last glorious victory. And the theory was, one, maybe the British will be caught off guard and will beat them. But privately, most admirals didn't think that. Second possibility is, we all go down to the sea in a flame of glory.
Gadadamrum.
Yes, Gadadamrum. And the enlisted men got hold of this, and their response was not only not to go, many of their officers who commanded them to go wound up getting an uninvited bath, in fact, drowned, because they were thrown overboard by their men. I mean, we're talking not just about people politely saying, I'm going to start a move-on petition. You know? No. I mean, they took their officers and threw the bastards, you know, into the North Sea. Right? And in fact, when they sent other ships that didn't know what was going on and said that the enemy has captured some of our ships and you should fire on them and so on, they ran up the red flag on the mutinying ships. And when they saw the red flag, they said, oh, those are our guys. And they threw their officers over and mutinied too. So you actually had, for a period of time, the average sailors, you know, along with some sympathetic lower-ranking officers, right? People who were there because they wanted to be an engineer, not because they wanted to kill people, that sort of thing, had gone over to them.
You're implying that the human psyche isn't built around killing other people, and that it's manifest in the resistance to the social structures that support an elite system that needs other working people to go out and kill other working people. I think that's...
Oh, absolutely. That's the other thing you could look at in terms of the development of military technology. What people found after World War I, and then was studied even more systematically after World War II, is that for all those huge firefights you have and all these battles you have, by and large, they're always elite units that are real kill, kill, kill. But for the average soldiers, most of them weren't aiming. They were firing in the direction of the enemy, not at a perceivable person they could shoot. And that allowed them to absolve themselves of any sort of feeling of guilt, because if they killed somebody, it wasn't their fault, sort of. They were just, you know, hazards of war. They were just doing it at random. And because of that, that is why modern armies have moved towards scatter guns, like the M16. These are guns that don't have much accuracy compared with the brilliant accuracy of rifles in World War I. The trouble with the rifles in World War I, accurate up to like, you know, half a mile, is you have to aim the damn thing. And the soldiers don't want to aim it. It's very easy for soldiers to just fire off round after round and not hit anyone.
I recently wrote a screed that I ended up posting. It was entitled, Ken Burns is Not a Therapist. And I'd like to speak about one of the several, the many, many, many problems with Ken Burns. First of all, I start by announcing that he's also not a historian. He's an entertainer. And I went on to indicate that there was a problem, a big problem, with Doris Kearns Goodwin, who's, would always, the caption always says, presidential historian, which is oxymoronic. There is no such thing as a presidential historian for very simple reasons, and Bill just elucidated them, but I tried in my screed also. Doris Kearns Goodwin is a biographer, and biography is not history. Biography is part of literature, and it's not history for two very simple reasons. One is, history is made by examining primary source documents, and biography almost never is. And the second reason is that biography relies on the great man theory of history. Otherwise, it's not much of a biography, is it? The great man theory of history that most people experience in their own lives in this country is names and dates. That went out of fashion with the Lindy Hop and the hand-cranked automobile.
If only that was true.
I go on to indicate that Ken Burns, in his introduction, his very first introductions to his most recent work on Vietnam, which I haven't seen, indicates that he's not so much trying to present a history or even inform people about what happened. He wants to start a national conversation, asking questions that have never been asked before that will lead to a natural healing. And then I want to go on to say he fancies himself some kind of therapist. And I end up by saying that what we don't get from Ken Burns
is a discussion of historical cause. And without putting too fine a point on historical cause and its manifoldness, I indicate that the reason Vietnam ended, in short, was because the military couldn't find soldiers to fight the war. And those soldiers went so far as to murder their officers who were too eager to fight that war. And that we're not going to learn that from Ken Burns. Even though I haven't seen it, I can promise you we're not going to hear that. So I'd like you to speak on that.
Well, first I'd like to point out that I stand second to no one in my complete contempt for Ken Burns.
Me. Second to me.
Okay, maybe second to Peter. Okay, but, I mean, this man is, you know, public broadcasting's answer to Joseph Goebbels. I mean, this man is detestable, right? And this is a problem because people tend to view things the way they're presented. And unfortunately, people, well-meaning people, view his documentaries as history. And as Peter explained in great detail, I needn't repeat him, these things are pure entertainment. And they're entertainment that appeals to the lowest, sappiest common denominator of, you know, your upper middle class suburban viewer. It's really nonsense. So the only documentary of his I could ever watch in detail was his one on baseball, because it's okay if you get sappy and sentimental about a stupid game. You're not necessarily distorting history of anything important. But even there, I mean, he said things that were, like, absolutely ridiculous. Like, for example, what makes baseball great is the statistics. Batting averages, home runs per game, number of walks given. I mean, oh, come on, give me a break. I like baseball too, but, you know, wake up, Ken. I mean, you know. So it's really detestable if it was only just Ken Burns. The problem is we have a whole culture that's become increasingly visual over the last 100 years. And even if the books were better, which they're not, when it comes to visual imagery, you've got nothing but sort of disinformation being put forth visually. On the one hand, there's the Ken Burns, who at least some people think are documentaries rather than, you know, melodramas and so on. But then there's all these Hollywood movies, right? I mean, there's Rambo, you know, the whole Rambo series, one of which Rambo manages to take out an armored Soviet assault helicopter with a bow and arrow. If it was that easy, I mean, the Soviet Union would have lost in Afghanistan in the first, like, 2 weeks. And, you know, in the various other Rambos where he goes to Vietnam and knocks off a couple North Vietnamese divisions single-handedly, or maybe with the hand, the, you know, help of some female lead that he's dragging around with him. I mean, you see all these pro-war movies, you see all these sort of things that just, you know, are so much sand in the eyes of the people, right? I mean, they tell not the true story, but they don't even tell a vaguely true story. Right? I mean, they don't even tell a great man history from the top down story. They just create myths, right? They just make up these mythologies. They're not even vaguely related to history. So there's very little history. And you mentioned this whole thing about the biographer posing, you know, cross-dressing as a historian. I mean, there's all these examples out there. I mean, it's just incredible. So, for example, I have students I have to fight with now. Forget about the old fights, you know, about revolution or Marx. Now it's evolution, again, a little bit, but that's okay. I can easily deal with that. But thanks to the so-called History Channel, I sometimes have to defend human agency in the sense that human beings could have built the pyramids. Because they've seen a program that the pyramids were made by ancient astronauts and UFOs, and there's these people from outer space made the pyramids for the Mayans, for the Egyptians, for everyone else, and they won't even give human agency in building tombs, right? And they see it on something called the History Channel, so therefore, sometimes if they're, you know, particularly gullible, most of my students are far more sharp than that, but I get them every once in a while, And, you know, they believe in space aliens. So I tell them, you're free to have any point of view you want in your essays, as long as it's supported by fact. However, you fail if you blame or credit anything that happened in history on ancient astronauts or UFOs. I mean, I got to draw the line somewhere, right? Now, that's a good example of a completely idiotic mystification, but it serves a certain purpose. It says that human beings are too dumb even to build their own historic monuments that we're familiar with, right? That these were all done not by human beings, but by space aliens. In other words, it's to reduce human beings even a lower level than we might otherwise think they are from the mainstream anti-democratic, anti-popular narrations. And I do hate Ken Burns.
Have you noticed, for example, the American news media? You saw on a corporate channel in the United States a dead body. What is really happening in this world? What are the things that are going on that we need to address?
Well, I think you're right. And I think one of the ways to do it is you don't want to see the violence. That's why, for example, right-wingers were in Germany after World War I used to picket protests. The Nazis used to throw stink bombs and smoke bombs in theaters that showed the movie All Quiet on the Western Front, because they didn't want anything that would show the reality of war and slanted towards an anti-war point of view. Now, you might not have that going on now, but now you have the fact that around the world, but particularly since Robert brought up the United States, they simply just don't show things. They just aren't shown. And if somebody makes an anti-war documentary, with luck, you find out about it on the internet. And you can watch it on the internet or buy a DVD online. But it's, you know, typically not shown, you know, on mainstream type televisions. Typically not shown there. And I think there's a big part of why they try to always minimize how much the damage of war is. On the one hand, they like to brag about the power of the weapons, but they don't want to then show the flip side, which is how many human beings, many of which had no part of this quarrel we're talking about, or whatever war we're talking about, were killed. So, for example, the British are past masters of this, and the Americans have learned from them. They never want to count or never want to talk about the tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of people that they have starved to death consciously. So like in World War I, when you combine the number of Germans who were starved to death because of the British blockade, which was something like 760,000, and the British acknowledge this, they're proud of it, in fact, and almost all of these were young children and old people, because the prime male warrior possibility, they were the ones that got the food, right? Or they're the ones strong enough they could withstand the lack of food. And they don't talk about the influenza epidemic, which was a direct result of World War I, which may have, according to some historians, killed as many people as were killed in battle, right? And then, of course, the British don't talk about how Winston Churchill was one of the greatest mass murderers of World War II when he deliberately prevented Australia from sending wheat that they had excess of. Let me repeat that. Australia had a surplus of wheat during World War II, and this was wheat that was not needed for the Allied war effort. Winston Churchill refused to let them send this to famine-stricken India, where we will not know whether it was 1 million or 2 million people died of hunger, because he wanted to stockpile the food for after the war. There's a very good book about this by an Indian historian, came out about 5 years ago. And he also thought that the famine might be useful because it might weaken the Indians in their drive for independence. And, of course, you could go back in history. The British, you know, were exporting food from Ireland during the potato famine, right? Again, thinking, well, if the Irish leave, that's okay. If the Irish die, well, life's tough. But this will help break the Irish resistance to us, right? They continue to export. Now, you don't have to take my word for it. The British government has apologized for the potato famine officially, I believe somewhere towards the beginning of this century. They've even admitted they did it. So you often don't hear much about what they call collateral damage. You know, you maybe get figures, ultimately about how many people were killed, but they often hush-hush and, you know, secret all the people who were killed sort of en passant, in passing, because of things. Like all the civilians that died in World War I, for example, by misdirected artillery fire or something, or by starvation, et cetera, et cetera. And that's the sort of thing that you often don't hear about. So they try to give you a sanitized version of the war. But let's look at Vietnam, since several people have brought this up, just as an example. My understanding is the best estimates are that there are 300,000 missing in action in Vietnam from the Vietnamese War. I'm talking about Vietnamese missing in action. And you see these flags everywhere about our POWs, MIAs, but what about theirs? And also, maybe the United States lost 55, 60,000 dead, but the Vietnamese lost like 3 million dead. And very, very rarely, well, maybe Ken Burns will bring it up, I don't know, but very, very rarely do you hear about, you know, the tremendous loss of human life on the, quote, other side, right? I mean, because you're talking about 3 million people dead in Vietnam, and that's virtual ethnic cleansing, genocide, massacres, call it what you want, right? Now, whether it was intentional or not, you know, when you call in an airstrike of napalm because there's one sniper in a village, the fact you got a bunch of kids and old men and women that weren't snipers doesn't matter. I mean, depending on how you want to look at it, right? I mean, so you can't...
Before Vietnam,
it was Korea. Of course, it was Korea.
3 million plus.
Yeah. And the point is, these are the figures that maybe we in this room have some familiarity with, but usually they're not trotted out. They're usually not mentioned. Usually not mentioned. So there's a lot of disinformation. Let me jump up to World War II. Americans would get the idea, completely mistakenly, that the United States defeated Nazi Germany in Europe. It was the Soviet Union that defeated Nazi Germany in Europe. We just came in when, you know, we invaded D-Day, hit the mainland in June 1944, right? There wasn't much left of the German elite troops by then, right? They'd been torn to bits in the snows of Russia. Now, ironically, if you say, well, every nation wants to have its nationalism, its patriotism, the United States could claim victory over, you know, Imperial Japan, because the United States was the prime military actor against Japan in Asia. But they don't, because somehow it's not as noble to defeat Asians, I guess, than to defeat Europeans. I assume it must be some sort of racist thing. But regardless, the point is, they don't take credit, they don't talk that much. I mean, just go... do a Google search of World War II movies, and there's far, far more about the Americans in Europe than there are about the Americans in Asia. Right? So you'd be forgiven to think that the Americans were the prime military actor against fascism in Europe, which just isn't true. While they were the prime military actor against fascist Japan, so, I mean, just in terms of just basic accuracy, right? Basic accuracy. World War II in Europe starts in 1939. The United States shows up on the real mainland in 44. Oh, I know they landed troops in North Africa to make sure ExxonMobil got their share of the oil reserves, you know, chase the German army out of North Africa. But I mean, in terms of really taking heavy casualties, really having an impact, the war had less than a year to go by June 44. The war's over in May 45.
I want to put in a plug for a movie which does a really very decent job of explaining how the left and others organized during the Vietnam War to help stop the Vietnam War in this country, and how they organized coffee shops and military newspapers, and that movie is called Sir No Sir.
I think that's a wonderful movie. I even don't mind the Vietnam and Television History, which is PBS, because they actually interview General Giap and various other people from, you know, the other side of Vietnam. It's much more balanced. It's not very, very radical, but I mean, it's balanced. It at least has different voices there. I think what I was trying to get at today, in all these various examples and sidesteps and responses to the question, was that we often forget that the common people, the average people, make up the vast bulk of humanity and all us have, that what they do or don't do either actively pursue or passively resist, is going to have an impact on history. In fact, it's not the only way of looking at history, but they often have a much, much greater impact on history than you would think. Just to throw out one last example while I'm summing up here, during World War II, you get the idea that the German robot workers would, of course, be doing everything they could to turn out weapons for, you know, their Führer and so on and so forth. Well, it turns out Tim Mason, a British historian, has found that comparatively, the German workers turned out less per hour than either British or American workers did, despite the fact that the penalty for any sort of shirking was 6 months in a concentration camp for the first offense, and so on. In other words, by their passive resistance, the German workers helped win the war for the Allies. For instance, in some of the key plants in the Ruhr that were turning out armaments, you had this problem that you were having a 20% average absentee rate. In other words, one out of five workers wasn't showing up. Things got so bad, for example, the German army wanted things time-stamped, as we would call it today, because they really didn't want equipment used in the first instance that was made in the afternoon. Because again, against rules, the German workers were often, and this is passive, not aggressive, having a quart of schnapps for lunch. And the stuff they produced in the afternoon was very, very shoddy. And every time they would arrest a couple hundred communists and socialists, you'd have the problem that, well, they were skilled workers and we're running out of workers, what are we going to do? So there'd be this fight between the Gestapo and the labor ministry. But by their passive resistance, right, by the fact that they refused to carry out this sort of production, it meant that even when Germany had superior equipment in a certain field of the old so-called military science, they couldn't produce it in sufficient numbers. They couldn't produce it in sufficient numbers. Because the German workers, whatever their beliefs, tended to be anti-Nazi. There weren't that many fanatical Nazis among the industrial working class in Germany. And that's just a proven sociological fact that everybody who studied it looks at. So again, I'm telling you to look at what the people do makes a big difference. Thank you.